Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for August's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European and RCVS recognized specialist in veterinary neurology, Katia Moroney-Henry. Thank you, Katia. I'm now going to hand over to you.
So, as I say, I hope this webinar will help you diagnose and treat some challenging seizure and other paroxysmal disorder in cats. And we're going to start with an 8-year-old female neutered domestic short hair. They presented with a chief complaint of acute onset of episodic behavioral changes and generalized seizures. This cat was last normal 1 week prior to presentation. And initially, the owner reported episodic behavioral changes characterized mainly by abnormal vocalizations and fearful behavior. After that, the cat started to present generalized tonic-clonic seizure, and those seizures were treated initially with intravenous diazepam at the emergency clinic. A minimal database was acquired also by the emergency clinic, including normal hematology and biochemistry. The only abnormality detected was moderate hyperglycemia that was considered secondary to the generalized seizure. The cat was discharged with at-home treatment with oral diazepam for 6 days, and she didn't experience any further generalized seizure. But she presented persistent episodic behavioral changes, and for this reason, she was referred to us. Before discussing the presentation of the case, I would like to point out that while oral diazepam could be theoretically used for the treatment of seizure in cats, we preferred not to use this medication in an oral form and for a prolonged period of time due to a report of a fatal fulminant hepatic failure. So we discontinued this treatment and we do not recommend using oral diazepam for the treatment of seizure in cats. On presentation, this cat appeared to have one of those episodes of abnormal behavior described by the client. She appeared to be staring motionless on top of the examination table. She presented lip smacking and she was drooling saliva. She was twitching her right eyelids and ear, and she appeared to be aware of the surroundings, but she was growling, which was not reported a normal behavior or vocalization by the client. While in this state of abnormal behavior, we assess the conscious proprioception and the manus response, which were both present and indicated some level of consciousness. She also had a normal palpebral reflex and the pupillary light reflex was present, despite having dilated mid-riatic pupil with mild anisocoria. Here we can see a video that showed the tail end of this episode. You can see the drooling of saliva. You can see the twitching, and you heard the vocalization. We can see it again. So, based on this video, based on this video, and especially based on the autonomic signs of the profuse salivation, but also the involuntary movement, the twitching of the right eyelids and ears, which was not clear in the video. It happened just a little bit we started recording. But especially based on this abnormal behavior, indicative of fear or anger, we localized the lesion to the forebrain. And we actually suspected that this episodic change in behavior represented a special type of focal seizures, that they are characteristic of feline temporal lobe epilepsy. These focal seizures are usually characterized by orofacial automatism, the salivation that you've seen in the video, facial twitching, lip smacking, chewing, licking, and swallowing. In feline temporal lobe epilepsy, we also see motor arrest, is a motionless staring. Sometimes we see head turning, and other autonomic signs like piloerection. Behavioral changes are a feature of temporal lobe epilepsy in both cats and humans. And in cats, they are usually represented by a searching behavior, by anger and fear. This focal seizure can be associated also or can evolve into generalized tonic-clonic seizure. Feline temporal lobe epilepsy could also be reproduced experimentally. At the beginning of the century, researchers showed that they could elicit the same type of seizure, focal and generalized, applying lesion to the hippocampus, which is the green part here, the amygdala, the red part, or the temporal cortex. Feline temporal lobe epilepsy is frequently associated with edema of the hippocampus and the piriform lobes on MRI. And here you can see an example of this edema in the hippocampus. This is a transverse section at the level of the hippocampus and, on a T2 weighted series. And we can see there is a bilateral increase in signal intensity in the hippocampus in T2 weighted. The same type of hyperintensity can be seen also in flare sequences, but usually it is not associated with contrast enhancement, as it's seen in, edema. Previously, this condition characterized by TIS MRI findings and feline temporal lobe epilepsy was indicated as hippocampal necrosis, and this name was given to this condition based on the postmortem findings. They are, as we say, hippocampal necrosis. And this condition was given a grave prognosis because almost all the patient had a fatal outcome. However, more recently, feline temporal lobe epilepsy has been associated with limbic encephalitis and autoantibodies. Limbic encephalitis was first described in humans, is an autoimmune condition, and in humans is often associated with distant tumors, so as part of a paraneoplastic syndrome. And in humans is diagnosed based on elevated levels of autoantibodies against voltage-gated potassium channel complexes, also called VGKC complexes. Limbic encephalitis has been investigated in cats by Atos Pakosti and his group at the University of Vienna, and they find that 36% of cats with temporal lobe epilepsy had also high level of VGKC complex autoantibodies, specifically directed toward a protein called LGI1. In their cases, they never find any association with distant tumors. So now we suspect that the cases of feline temporal lobe epilepsy are secondary to limbic encephalitis. And this is important because, as we learn from autoimmune encephalitis in humans, limbic encephalitis and autoimmune encephalitis in humans tends to affect young patients. In humans, they're often paraneoplastic, but if they're not associated with distant tumor, autoimmune encephalitis tends to respond well to immunotherapy. In previously, this patient, they were not expected to recover. So if you apply the same treatment in cats, we should also expect a better outcome. And this is what happened in our case. We're now back to our 8-year-old female neutered domestic shore cat with focal and generalized seizure. The acute treatment consisted in discontinuation of the oral diazepam, obviously, and introduction of phenobarbital and gabapentin, and treatment with prednisolone, immunotherapy with prednisolone. We were then able to slowly taper and discontinuing the prednisolone and gabapentin, and the cat was treated with phenobarbital. The outcome is that the cat is alive with a good seizure control 2 years after the onset of treatment. However, she experienced one severe recurrence of seizure after an attempt to taper and discontinue phenobarbital. The final diagnosis for this case is temporal lobe epilepsy and suspected limbic encephalitis. This cat had negative serology for VGKC complex autoantibodies. However, the clinical presentation with feline temporal lobe epilepsy in response to immunotherapy is highly suggestive of autoimmune encephalitis, specifically a limbic encephalitis. So what is the take-home message from this case? The take-home message is that it's very important to be able to recognize focal seizure associated with temporal lobe epilepsy. They have a very specific semiology. The diagnosis of feline hippocampal necrosis or limbic encephalitis is not always associated with a poor prognosis. So cats that are treated aggressively and with the correct treatment, they have a good prognosis or a better prognosis. And we need to remember the treatment of limbic encephalitis or in general autoimmune encephalitis needs to include immunotherapy in addition to antiepileptic therapy. And finally, we need to remember that in some cases, despite a successful treatment with immunotherapy, lifelong treatment with antiepileptic drugs may be required. Now, if there are no questions, let's move to the next case. This is an older cat. We're now discussing a case of a 13-year-old male neutered domestic short hair. They presented with a chief complaint of acute onset of seizure-like episodes. The owner described 4 seizure-like episodes in the week preceding the consultation, and they described his seizure-like episode as characterized by motion arrest, dilated pupils, lifting of the front paw toward the face, and involuntary defecation. The average duration of the episode was around 30 seconds. But one episode, characterized by tachypnea and motionless staring, lasted approximately 30 minutes and prompted him to seek referral. On presentation, this elderly cat had a normal physical and neurological examination. Hematology, biochemistry, and T4 were also normal. An MRI of the brain was performed and spinal fluid analysis, and they were both normal. Finally, we performed serology for infectious diseases, Toxoplasma gondii, FELV, FIV, and Cryptococcus neoformans. In this case, we also recommended performing ECG and echocardiogram. This was based on the fact that we didn't have a clear description of the seizure-like episode, and seizure-like episode have been reported also in cat with intermittent high-grade atrioventricular dysfunction. And we wanted to rule out as much as possible the presence of similar arrhythmia. The cat was then discharged without any specific treatment because we wanted to collect more information on the nature of this episode. And we requested the client to record a video when possible. And here we can see the video. This was the tail end of an episode, which we're going to show it again. Initially, there was an involuntary defecation, and then you notice this involuntary movement, these tremors, almost like titubation of the body and head of the cat. The cat was also lip smacking, but we don't see any drooling. So, based on the review of the video, based on the diagnostic workup that was basically negative in the normal neurological examination, we suspected that this was a form of focal epilepsy of unknown cause. Now, let me mention a little bit some changes in the terminology of epilepsy in cats and dogs. Until recently, we would have used potentially the terminology of idiopathic epilepsy, which is still valid in some cases. But we now try to refer to idiopathic epilepsy only for dogs and humans that they have an epilepsy of presumed genetic etiology. And genetic epilepsy have never been recognized in client-owned cats. There is just one report of genetic epilepsy in a group of cats in a laboratory in Japan. So when we have epilepsy of a known cause, we don't refer to idiopathic epilepsy. We could use also the term cryptogenic epilepsy, which again is still valid, but is not recommended nowadays. Nowadays, when we have an epilepsy of a known cause in an elderly patient, we prefer to refer to it as epilepsy of a known cause, as recommended by the International League Against Epilepsy. Is to differentiate it from structural epilepsy, which is associated with structural lesion to the brain, like tumor, infectious, inflammation, malformation. And is to differentiate it from toxic or metabolic epilepsy, caused obviously by toxic and metabolic causes. A recent study in a cohort of 81 cats tried to provide more information about the prevalence of epilepsy of unknown cause in cats, and find that 22% of the cats had an epilepsy without any cause that could be identified by a complete workup, including MRI and spinal fluid analysis. The prevalence of epilepsy of unknown cause or idiopathic epilepsy in this group of cats is less than what previously reported in other study. And this can be explained with the fact that now more and more nowadays the MRI examination are more frequently proposed to owners of epileptic cat, and especially because now we recognize hippocampal necrosis, also called limbic encephalitis, in cats as part of the structural epilepsy, while previously was included in the group in the category of epilepsy of unknown cause. Cats with epilepsy of unknown cause are usually have a median age of seizure onset of 3.5 years, so usually they are middle age, young, but some of them can be significantly older. As you can see in the range, they were also 14-year-old cats, a little bit like our cat that was 13-year-old. Interestingly, focal or focal onset seizure were reported in 50% of the cat with a diagnosis of epilepsy of unknown cause. So, focal seizure were more common in EUC than in cats with epilepsy associated with structural lesion or secondary to toxic or metabolic causes. This is interesting, and it's possible that it was limited to this cohort of patient. But is also what happened in our case. We suspected that our 13-year-old cat had an epilepsy of unknown cause, and the epilepsy was a focal epilepsy because, as you notice, was not involving the whole body. Cat with epilepsy of unknown cause tend to have a good survival rate in the first year, 73%, they're still alive in the study that I'm referencing here, and they tend to respond to phenobarbital treatment in a good percentage of cases. So, returning to our case, our 13-year-old male neutered domestic short hair with epilepsy of unknown cause, we initiated treatment with phenobarbital, and we had a complete resolution of the seizure, complete remission for 7 months. We then attempted tapering the phenobarbital and discontinued it. But 3 months later, he had a recurrence of seizure. Therefore, treatment with phenobarbital were restarted. 1 year after diagnosis, he was still seizure-free, but was then lost to the follow-up. So the final diagnosis in this case was epilepsy of unknown cause. And in this case, we were lucky because we didn't have any limitation in the diagnostic workup, so we were able to perform a complete diagnostic workup and be quite confident with this diagnosis. But this is not always possible. There will be cases in which, due to financial limitation, it may not be possible to perform such an extensive workup, including MRI, CSF tap, and even a cardiology assessment. So a recent study on cats with epilepsy may help deciding when to recommend referral, or when we should suspect the presence of structural lesion as a cause for the epilepsy. In this study, they find that cats with an abnormal interictal neurological examination means that the neurological examination is performed far from a seizure episode, and the abnormality are not simply postictal abnormality. So cats with an abnormal interictal neurological examination are more likely than cat with a normal neurological examination to have a structural epilepsy, and therefore further diagnostic investigation should be recommended. The same applies to cats that they have the first seizure reported at the age of 7 years or older. Pedigree cats, they seem to have more chances to have structural epilepsy than non-pedigree cats. And cats presented with ictal vocalization, also, they have more chances to have structural epilepsy. As you may remember from the first case, ictal vocalization, so abnormal vocalization during seizure, is one of the characteristics of limbic encephalitis. And limbic encephalitis obviously will be included in structural epilepsy because it's a form of, it's basically an autoimmune encephalitis. So, what is the take-home message from this case? A diagnosis of epilepsy of unknown cause doesn't have to be associated with a poor prognosis, even in elderly cats. And the cats, pedigree cats, cats with abnormal neurological examination, and cats that they were older than 7 years, 7 years older at the onset of the seizure, and cats presenting ictal vocalization are more likely to have a structural cause of epilepsy, and therefore it would be more important in these cases to recommend a diagnostic workup, as done in this case. The next case is concerning a 6 year and 10 months old epileptic cat, male neutered domestic short hair. This cat has a chronic history of epilepsy, but it was presented for three chief main complaints. The first complaint was intermittent facial and whole body muscle twitching, more evident at rest, that had been noticed 2.5 months prior to presentation. Another complaint was that the seizure frequency and severity was increasing, despite, again, a chronic history of epilepsy. And finally, the cat presented with anorexia. Now, more in detail, the first generalized tonic-clonic seizure had been witnessed by the owners when the cat was less than a year in age. The primary veterinarian had achieved a good seizure control with phenobarbital therapy, and the cat was experiencing only breakthrough seizure only once or twice a year. The cat had a normal interictal neurological examination initially, and therefore the diagnosis was suspected epilepsy of unknown cause. When the owner first reported an increase in frequency and severity of the generalized seizure, The primary veterinarian had checked the serum level of phenobarbital and found it to be nicely within the middle of the recommended therapeutic range, but decided anyway to increase slightly the dose of phenobarbital. And the seizure frequency remained to be high, to one seizure per week. In addition, the clients, in addition to the generalized tonic-clonic seizure, the client reported also witnessing this type of episode characterized by muscle twitching. As you can see in this short video, there is intermittent twitching of both eyelids. The cat is at rest but not asleep. And we can see again the video. There is no, like in a difference than the first case that I show you today, there is no vocalization, the cat appears quite relaxed, and there is no excessive drooling or lip smacking. But still, these episodes are concerning. So the cat was referred to us. We perform a physical and neurological examination, and the only abnormality was a very mild delay in repositioning the left hind paw. Hematology, biochemistry, including electrolytes, T4, and serology for toxoplasma were all within normal limits. Tests for feline leukemia virus and FIV were also negative. We then recommended performing an MRI and spinal fluid analysis. The spinal fluid analysis was normal, but the MRI showed the following lesion. Let's start with the image on the right. It's a T2 weighted dorsal image, and we have the nose of the animal is here and the neck is here. And now you can notice if we draw an imaginary line and we compare the left cerebral hemisphere with the right cerebral hemisphere, we see that they are asymmetrical, and we see that there is a defect in the frontal bone and part of the brain and meninges. They basically herniate from through this bony defect within the nasal cavity, and they are also in contact with the right frontal sinus. Let's look now at the images on the left. This is a T2 weighted transverse image at the level of the eyes and the frontal olfactory lobe. And as you can see, this is the part of the brain that is herniated. There is also a little cystic lesion here. And another thing that you notice below, we have the post-contrast, a T1 weighted post-contrast image. As you can see, we have already arrow here. There is an uptake of contrast of the tissue, leaning the soft tissue, the lining of the right frontal sinus. And there is also an increased uptake of contrast in the meninges in correspondence of the right frontal sinus. So when we have an herniation of the meninges and part of the brain parenchyma through a bony defect in the calvarium, we define this a meningoencephalocele. And in cats, meningoencephalocele has been reported as a hereditary condition in a family of Burmese cats, but most often is a sporadic congenital malformation that in the most severe cases, like the one in this image below, has to be treated surgically. However, in cases like the one presented here, in a almost 7-year-old cat that was that responded well to medical treatment, we would not recommend immediately surgical treatment. In our case, we decided to implement the following treatment. We added gabapentin to the treatment with phenobarbital, because phenobarbital had still to reach a steady state in the blood of this cat, so we decided to just improve the seizure control with gabapentin. But also we weren't sure that the episode that I showed you in the video before, there were indeed focal seizures. We suspected the death and the anorexia may be secondary potentially to an episode of pain. And that's why we decided also to add gabapentin as a painkiller for neuropathic pain. We also add amoxicillin clavulanate, so a broad-spectrum antibiotic for the treatment of the sinusitis, and prednisolone for the treatment of what we suspected it may have been a focal meningitis. And this led to a remission of clinical signs. So based on the result of the diagnostic workup and also response to treatment, we suspected that the meningoencephalocele was a congenital lesion, a congenital malformation, and that the recent deterioration in the seizure frequency at the onset of these episodes of muscle twitching and anorexia were secondary to a sinusitis and possibly a focal meningitis encephalitis by proximity with an area of inflammation of the sinus. So in this case, once again, we had the possibility to perform a complete diagnostic workup, including an MRI and CSF, but this may not always be possible. So what should we do when we are presented with an epileptic cat that has a normal neurological examination? Should we recommend to perform immediately an MRI or not? A recent study, a retrospective study, tried to answer this question. They looked at a cohort of cat that again had a diagnosis of epilepsy, and they had a normal interictal neurological examination. And they find out that only a very small percentage of cat aged between 1 and 6 years at the onset of the seizure presented with structural abnormality, with MRI abnormalities. And there were only 5% of the cat. However, if they first seizure were reported before 1 year of age, 9% of those cats presented with MRI abnormality. And interestingly, all were congenital malformation. If the first seizure was witnessed in cats that were 6 years or older, then in this study, 23% of the cases of the cats presented abnormalities in MRI and most likely associated with neoplastic lesion. So what is the take-home message from this case? A diagnosis of epilepsy of unknown cause or idiopathic epilepsy should be re-evaluated, re-investigated in case of changes in seizure pattern. And epileptic cats that they have a seizure onset before the age of 1 or after the age of 6 are more likely to have a structural epilepsy despite having a normal interictal neurological examination. So now, if you don't have any question, the last case that I would like to present today is slightly different. First of all, is a younger cat, is a 1 year and 3 months old male neutered domestic short hair. They presented with a chief complaint of episodes of running aimlessly, vocalizing, licking and attacking the tail, leading to self-traumatism, self-mutilation. And it was described as a last normal approximately 1 year before presentation. So this episode, they started very early on in life when it was still a 3 months old kitten. And it was referred to the Royal Dick Vet for a progressive increase in the frequency and especially in the severity of this episode. The self-mutilation of the tip of the tail had led to the need to perform 2 partial caudectomies. And the episode was still increasing in frequency from weekly to multiple episodes per day. The cat was forced to wear an Elizabethan collar at all times, but still at times it could reach his tail and flank and cause traumatism. There had been a partial improvement with immunosuppressive doses of prednisolone, but a recurrence had been ex was ex by recurrence was noted after the tapering dose of the treatment. And the primary veterinarian had implemented a treatment with gabapentin and phenobarbital based on a suspicion of potentially a focal seizure. But this did not appear to be successful in controlling the episode, and for this reason the cat was referred to us. And now we're going to show a video of one of these episodes that actually occurred in the consulting room. As you can see, the cat is running around aimlessly, is attacking his tail, is trying to reach his tail despite wearing an Elizabethan collar, is trying to reach his flanks. And it's not possible to hear it, but he was also vocalizing, he was growling while attacking his tail. So we perform a neurological examination, a physical and neurological examination, and these were the main findings. We find some skin lesions, some lesion in the distal tail, and we also find lumbar hyperesthesia. If the dorsal lumbar area was touched, even a gentle touch, this was triggering exaggerated cutaneous tronchi reflex, so a rippling of the skin. And it was also triggering one of these episodes, that's what we have seen in the previous video, aggressive behavior, and the cat was attacking his tail and flank in response to lumbar hyperesthesia. So his ability to elicit an episode is not typical of a seizure, and so the semiology was not compatible with a focal seizure. Nevertheless, we decided to perform a complete workup. We started with hematology, biochemistry and electrolytes, serology for toxoplasma, FELV and FIV, and they were all normal. We also performed an MRI of the brain to investigate the possibility that this could be a focal seizure. And an MRI was also including the thoracolumbar and sacral and caudal spine. So an MRI of the whole spine, including the tail. And the only abnormality detected was a focal area of contrast enhancement in the gluteal muscle. The most likely differential diagnosis was focal myositis, possibly secondary to trauma. We also performed electromyography, EMG, to detect if there was any diffuse abnormality affecting the muscle. But we find only a mild abnormal spontaneous muscle activity in the muscle of the tip of the tail. And again, we suspect it is most likely secondary to trauma. Cerebrospinal fluid analysis after a lumbar tap was also normal. So the diagnosis was feline hyperesthesia syndrome. Recently, we published a study, a retrospective study, on a small cohort of cats with this condition, and they had a complete diagnostic workup. This is the first study of this type, and we included cat presented with skin rippling over the dorsal lumbar area, episode of jumping and running, excessive vocalization, tail chasing, and especially in the most severe cases with self-trauma to the tail and the flank. Anecdotally, this condition, feline hyperesthesia syndrome, has been reported potentially as a form of focal epilepsy or has been reported associated with spinal cord lesion or myopathy. But our diagnostic workup was negative for central or peripheral neurological problems. An hypersensitivity dermatitis was suspected in 2 of the 7 cases in this study. Unfortunately, most of these cats they already presented with some therapeutic trial, so it was difficult sometimes to diagnose the condition, because some of these cats already been treated with corticosteroids. Also, primary or secondary behavioral problems could not be completely ruled out, because especially many of the, because these cases were tend to be more chronic, and therefore secondary behavioral problems cannot be discounted. In this small cohort of patient, we find the gabapentin was the most successful treatment, either alone, especially for the milder cases and the cases that they were promptly treated, or in combination with anti-inflammatory and psychotropic drugs in the most chronic and most severe cases. Returning to our case, our one-year-old cat with a diagnosis of feline hyperesthesia syndrome, we restarted treatment with prednisolone at immunosuppressive doses, and we slowly tapered the medication. We increased the dose of phenobarbital and checked that they were within a therapeutic level, and added gabapentin again. And we obtained a complete remission of the clinical signs. However, the owner had some concern about the side effect associated with prednisolone treatment, especially the weight gain. And so we had to taper this medication, and there was a recurrence of clinical signs, of feline hyperesthesia signs. We also, but at the recurrence, we re-examined the patient, and we noticed also that upon discontinuing the prednisolone, we noticed the presence of dermatological lesion that they led us to a clinical suspicion of clean hypersensitivity. We then recommended a dietary trial, which failed also due to poor compliance of the cat. It was an outdoor cat, so he had access to other source of food. And we finally achieved a remission of the clinical signs with a combination of gabapentin, amitriptyline, and cyclosporine. And the cat now is more than 2 years after the diagnosis, and he had a remission with just one recurrence secondary to the fact that he had been missing for a few days and he couldn't receive his medication. So the final diagnosis in this specific case was feline hyperesthesia syndrome, and we suspected it was triggered initially by underlying dermatological problem and exacerbated by a behavioral problem that they ensue due to the chronicity of this problem. And what is the take-home message from this case? That feline hyperesthesia syndrome is a complex and multifactorial disorder that require an investigation of possible dermatological and behavioral problems, but also neurological and musculoskeletal causes of hyperesthesia. And we need to remember that even if the triggering event could have been a dermatological or neurological problem, behavioral problems are likely to ensue in almost all the cases, almost the chronic cases. So, thank you for your attention, and I will take any question that you might have at this time. Thank you very much. If you have any further question, please email it to me.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Katia for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.